Is this better?
Uh-huh.
So, I will talk about recognition of afterfaults and how to date past earthquakes. And some of the topics I will cover will be the morphology of afterfaults, and I'll use examples from the United States, and specifically mainly from California, Alaska, and Baja California. Then I will talk about some of the methods that we use in California to assess the rates of afterfault in its grain accumulation, and maybe how some of this can be applied to the Czech Republic. We'll talk about paleoseismic methods. I'll give an example from one of the major strands of the San Andreas Fault System in Southern California, and then we'll discuss how to actually resolve displacement on a fault so we can get an estimate of the size of past earthquakes. So, first on the morphology of active strike slip faults, and I'm going to focus a lot of this on strike slip faults in part because the faults so far that I've worked with here in the Czech Republic have been dominantly strike slip. So I think it's useful to evaluate what an active strike slip fault looks like and then compare it to the ones in the Czech Republic. What we'll find is that there are very clear morphologic features that are indicative of active strike slip faults. Among these are scarps and alluvium, deflected drainages, sag ponds, shutter ridges. I'll show you examples of these. And then some less diagnostic in terms of activity might be aligned notches and side hill benches. One thing we find in California and elsewhere in the world is that active faults tend to bury themselves. So they're typically generating alluvium. When you have a fault that is entirely within rock at the surface, it's generally not producing alluvium. If there's a dipsa component, it's usually indicative of a very, very low rate. So, a few examples. This is the Denali Fault in Alaska, which ruptured in 2002. And one general rule is that active faults define their own morphology. They're very easy to recognize in the landscape because they define the landscape. In detail, active faults have features like offset drainages, like this one here, sag ponds. There's a couple little sag ponds here. This photo was actually taken before the 2002 magnitude 7.9 earthquake, and small offsets like this one right here were used to estimate the size of displacement in the past earthquakes. And based on this, they designed the Alaska pipeline to accommodate 6 meters of displacement. And in fact, in 2002, this fault produced in the area of the Alaskan pipeline 6 meters of displacement. So we're very effective in using geomorphology and geology to estimate the size of potential future earthquakes. This is the San Jacinto Fault in Southern California. One characteristic feature along active strike slip faults are offset channels. This is a channel that's offset nearly 600 or 200 meters, and there's another one that's offset over here that's about 600 meters from the same source. And you can tell this is an active fault because there's fault trenches and a red line. It's very indicative of an active fault. Okay, so this is the Agua Blanca fault. Oh, I should mention that in this case, this is about a 15 millimeter a year fault, so a very, very fast slip rate. This one is maybe a little more subdued in morphology. This is about 5 millimeters a year. This is the Agua Blanca fault in Baja California, Mexico, but it has many of the same features. Scarp crossing Holocene alluvium. This is a pressure ridge, a little push up along the fault. This alluvial fan here was derived from this pluton over here, so it's been offset kilometers along the fault. And this is another photo showing the Agua Blanca fault, very clean offset of a channel, very nice scarp and shutter ridge. So very clear indicators of youthful faulting. This is the Garlock Fault. It's also about 5 millimeters a year in the Mojave Desert. And again, very clear expression across the landscape. Closed depressions. There's a fault trench. There's another closed depression here. There's another view of the same fault. And very, very clear expression across the landscape. As the slip rate decreases, faults become less well expressed. This is the Southern Elsinore Fault. It has a slip rate of about 1.6 millimeters a year. And although we can use provenance to determine offset fans, these fans here originated from this drainage based on the type of alluvium that is within the deposits, there's not as much clear expression of offset. There's no very few big channel offsets in this area, but they're still there in some detail. Similarly, this is the Whittier Fault in the Los Angeles Basin, and each of these drainages that comes up has a big off-centered drainage deflection along it, this one here. And this is about 2.5 millimeters a year. Now, when you get down to fault slip rates that are less than 0.5 millimeter a year, a lot of the morphology that we normally attribute to active strikes of fault starts to disappear. This is the San Miguel Fault in Baja California, and its long-term slip rate is 0.2 millimeters a year. And one thing which is clearly evident right off is that channels that cross the fault show little or no deflection. There's bedrock exposed on both sides, even though there's a very recognizable scarp line here. There's very little alluvium being generated by the slight vertical motion on this fault. So typical of very low slip rate faults, even though they're still active and they're still evident in the morphology, they lose that expression of strike slip. In other words, the effects of drainage and denudation of the landscape overrule the effects of faulting. So if we look at some faults here in the Czech Republic, this is a synodic marginal fault, and again, at the regional scale, you can see the fault very clearly. This is a Google Earth image. This is right near the Polish border. And when you look in detail, the fault, even though it's expressed generally in the landscape, you won't see much in the way of deflected drainages. So it's very, you know, this indicates, again, a very low slip rate. If you use a bit LIDAR, this is that same section of the fault, very well expressed in the regional scale. But looking in detail, you don't see the detailed expression of offset channels, pressure ridges, sag ponds, other things that indicate a higher slip rate fault. So far, from what I've seen in the Czech Republic, this and other faults fall into the very low slip rate category for the long-term slip rate. This is the Marinsky Lanza Fault near Bohemia, or in Bohemia. And again, very well defined at the regional scale. This is the fault here, the Czech Basin. And when you look in detail at the fault, you don't have the expression of nice deflected drainages and whatnot. One thing to note here, too, is this cannot have much of a vertical rate because even the basin itself is being incised. The drainages are incising both the hanging wall and the flow wall across the fault zone. This is a LIDAR image showing the same thing. And complete lack of nice deflected drainages indicate that this in the long term is a low slip rate fault. So it's consistent with the tenth of a millimeter, you know, kind of rate as opposed to the millimeters and 10 and centimeter type of slip rate when we compare it to active faults in California. So I will now address how we look at modern strain rates in California. We use a number of old and new techniques. I'll just cover a couple of them. One, GPS, which I'm sure you're familiar with. INSAR, which you may not have used here because the rates are so low, but I think it still could be useful from a regional perspective. In California, we have hundreds of continuous GPS stations, and these measure the velocity across the plate margin. We have about a 50 millimeter a year plate margin, so it's at least two orders of magnitude or more higher rate than anything in the Czech Republic. Nevertheless, a couple very interesting things. One, this shows the velocity of the Pacific plate relative to North America, so all the arrows over here are very small, you know, within their uncertainties, and these are elongated at about 45 to 50 millimeters per year towards the northwest. One thing we can see among some faults is where the strain fields are very narrow or localized along the fault. This indicates creep. So one of the questions that's been asked in the past is, are any of the faults in the Czech Republic creeping? And this is something that may be visible not only with GPS, but with INSAR. This is an INSAR image of the same area. And even though this is high slip rate, you see a very abrupt change in relative velocities. which indicate that it's creeping. Faults that are not creeping have a very gradual change in these colors, the colors related to the relative velocity across the fault. So here's another example from the Bay Area where areas that have a gradual change, in this case across the fault, are locked and accumulating elastic strain, where you have a very abrupt change in color across the fault. These are creeping, or at least creeping in part. This is the Hayward Fault, which is known to be creeping at about half of its long-term slip rate. This is the same image right here with different color, but you can see the very abrupt change across the fault, which indicates some component of creep. So, even though, I should mention that when we're using permanent reflectors or permanent scatterers, basically you're looking at thousands or tens of thousands of potential monuments. And I think on, I guess, the next slide, this is a comparison of GPS and survey arrays versus using these permanent scatterers. All these gray dots, these thousands of gray dots, are from INSAR, and they read extremely well with GPS. So it's something that can be done very effectively. And in the Czech Republic, permanent scatterers would be every building, street, anything that doesn't change with the seasons. And I think there's plenty of those, and you can look at the entire strain field across the Czech Republic and see if you're seeing long-term strain accumulation over the entire region and potentially even across individual faults, although individual faults are probably proving strain at such a low rate you won't see it in the MSR, but you might be able to see if there's any strain accumulation across the entire region. Also, we compare these INSAR rates and GPS rates to geologic rates. This is just the one example I use for how we determine geologic rates. In this case, we go back to this offset channel. This is incised into an alluvial fan. And there's another channel here which is incised into the same fan complex. We can reconstruct these to their original geometry. This is the fan system here. And based on cosmogenic nuclei depth profiles, we can establish the age of this fan surface. And we've done this here. This gives us an age of about 45,000 years. This is offset nearly 600 meters. So we know from these types of studies, we get a slip right here, 13 millimeters a year. This is indistinguishable from the geodetic rates, the INSAR rate, and the GPS rate. Okay, so paleoseismology. This is a study of past earthquakes on a fault. We use a variety of techniques, including surface and subsurface mapping, trenching, and various dating techniques to establish the earthquake chronology. And this allows us to understand the long-term earthquake production and behavior of individual faults, as well as looking at an entire fault system and how faults may interact in a region. For this talk, I'm going to primarily, for this first part, cover 2D interpretation of earthquakes as we see in trenches, and then we're going to go to look at how we resolve displacement in 3D to develop a complete rupture history for a fault. And I'll use an example from a trenching study we did in Turkey on the North Anatolia Fault. So I found over the years that for any paleoseismic record, the site selection is absolutely key. If you have lousy stratigraphy, you won't get much of a record. And so in California, we found that the very best sites happen to be wet sites. And our trench site is this lake. This looks like a formidable task. However, fortunately, it's only wet in the winter. In the summer, it tends to dry out. But this is usually assures that you'll have plenty to date, lots of organic material, and it also suppresses bioturbation of animals, which for a lot of trench sites in California has destroyed in the seismic record. So for a little background, this is Hog Lake here, the site I just showed you. This is the San Jacinto Fault, which is the western branch of the San Andreas Fault in Southern California. So between these two faults, they accrue about 80% of the plate motion, about 40 millimeters a year. So these are very active faults that produce frequent large earthquakes. And the site that we'll be looking at is a hot lake, and then I will compare it to another lake site, Mystic Lake here, and we'll see how we can compare the rupture histories, the earthquake histories, for two sites that are only 50 kilometers apart. So total fault displacement along the San Jacinto Fault of Hot Lake is about 24 kilometers. And this is based on matching of what's called the Thomas Mountain Sill. This plutonic body here matches for about 24 kilometers of reconstruction. And all of this displacement has occurred in the last 2 million years. So we know that the long-term average rate is about 12 millimeters a year. And then based on geomorphic studies, we've determined the displacement field for the last large earthquake in 1800 and a smaller earthquake in 1918. And plotted here also are in blue dots. These are slip rate studies that we've done along the length of this fault. And it turns out that the slip rates track the amount of displacement in the last earthquake. So we can make the argument that repeated earthquakes, like 1800, repeated over and over again, build the slip rate on the fault. So this is very common for California earthquakes, where you're dealing with plate margin slip and rapid strain accumulation. In the geomorphology, the way we reconstruct this this curve here with all these yellow dots, each of these yellow dots represents a field measurement where we had very clear expression in the fault offsetting a small channel. So here we have a small channel. The fault is at the scarp coming down finger like this. The channel wall is offset, as is the thaw leg of the channel, about 3.5 meters. And this is displacement that occurred in the 1800 earthquake. And we've measured 500 of these features over a distance of only 80 kilometers along the fault to resolve the displacement field of this earthquake plus some previous earthquakes. Okay, so on to the trenches. This is what it looks like when it's wet. Here's all of our trenches. But fortunately, in the summer, it's dry. I probably should tell you that the total depth of this lake is only 1.5 meters, so it's not a very deep lake. And it dries out in most summers, so it makes it easy for access. And so we have all the trenches in the middle of the pond there. Should also mention, the first trenches went all the way across. Just to locate, we wanted to make sure we knew where all the strands of the fault were, so we trenched all the way across the entire depression in a number of places to locate the zone of active faulting. And then came in and did some very detailed trenches in the middle of the sag depression. And again, the reason we really like sites like this is because they have remarkable stratigraphy. The stratigraphy is measured at the centimeter scale of bedding, so very, very fine scale bedding. And as with most excavations of this type, we would grid them up, photograph the panels, and then produce these mosaic trench logs like this. So each of these little dark bands here had charcoal and seeds and reed growth and represented a pond surface at some point in the past. And then the main fault ruptures up through here. A secondary fault comes up through like this, and this strand of the fault died a few hundred years ago and doesn't fault the upper part of the stratigraphy. And this has been the main strand of the fault for the last several earthquakes. We ultimately dug as deep as 6.5 meters below the water table, below the bottom of the lake. We had to pump water continually during this period, but this allowed us to develop about a 4,000-year record of earthquakes for the strand of the fault and recorded 21 surface ruptures. So some of the things you have to be careful about for these types of studies is a single trench rarely captures the entire earthquake history. And I use this example where here, if you see this orange unit, this is unit 100, that's the same as this unit 100. There's an earthquake that's hidden within this part of the record right here because it's just not very well expressed in this particular cut. And then the fault cut up to this level and offset the sand unit, which is the same as I think this guy. You might want to get another battery for this. Okay, so the point here is that in the upper diagram, the last two large ruptures broke on individual strands that are about a half meter apart, whereas in the lower right diagram, they broke in exactly the same trace, and the most recent rupture obscured the evidence of the previous rupture. So what we have found is that it's very important to excavate multiple trenches to try to capture the full earthquake history of a fault. Okay, so here's another example. This is another exposure. The main rupture is over on the right side. You can see the fault come up and is capped by unbroken stratigraphy. At the same time, it produced a fold. So there was a small secondary breakout fold that was generated in the same earthquake. And, in fact, it also accumulated what we call growth strata, where it has an extra pulse of sedimentation that was associated just with this earthquake and with some previous earthquakes. So very commonly, it's these secondary features that have some of the best expression of faulting for any individual earthquake. Because if you always break in the same place, it's going to obscure earlier earthquake activity, whereas if you have secondary structures that break, then you get a better expression of past earthquakes. Here's another example. One thing we commonly see along these type of ruptures are fissure fills, and that means during a ground rupture you produce a fissure that extends down into the ground. Thank you, Yelton. Like this, and it's filled with organic debris. And at the same level we have an angular unconformity. We have the other half or another fissure up here, and then it's capped by bedded stratigraphy above it. So we use these types of features to help document the existence of a past surface rupture. Here's another example where this was probably the main strand of the fault for a period of time, and then it jumped over to this strand here. So we have many faults that come up and are capped by bedded stratigraphy here, which indicates that this was the ground surface at the time of an earthquake. We have liquefaction in these deposits. One thing that indicates that it was seismic. And then these particular fault strands have not moved since deposition of these units. So we can date these units. We can date these units here. And from that, we can establish the timing of an earthquake. As I mentioned, the entire stratigraphy was filled with many types of material to date. We had charcoal, we had seeds, we had shells, and we had pieces of wood. And we found that the seeds gave the most reliable date because they're single year growths. Charcoal dates the time of wood growth and death, and that can be tens to hundreds of years or even longer prior to its deposition. So we found that charcoal is always older than the age of the deposit itself, whereas the seeds gave very reliable ages. So most of the dates we have from this site, 111 radiocarbon dates, and about 100 of them fell in stratigraphic order. Most of those were all seed dates. So what you can do is plot the radiocarbon age against the unit, which is a proxy for depth, and all of the dates that fall on or close to the green line within uncertainty are all in stratigraphic order. The ones that date to the right of it have some inheritance, and almost every one of these had inheritance. In other words, some primary age at the time of deposition, they are all charcoal. So we developed our models based primarily on the seed chronologies. I don't expect you to see any of this. What I'm going to point out is just based on the two, we took the very best dates for one model. We took everything that would run in a program called OxCow for the other model. And you'll notice that each of these little blips here is a probability distribution function, and they're all in stratigraphic order for the entire section. This is remarkable. It's the only site I've worked on where everything is in stratigraphic order. And from that, we developed two chronologic models for the ruptures, what you're looking at, each of these little colored bumps is a probability distribution for the age of the earthquake. So the highest likelihood age is the peak of the distribution. And for the two different models, this is the one running for the best radiocarbon dates. This is the one running all the radiocarbon dates. You notice that most of these bumps don't change much. They may shift a little bit. There's a little bit, for instance, this one becomes more broad in distribution. We toss out a couple dates, similar as this one here. It gets a little bit younger as we toss out the dates that had some age inheritance. But most of these did not move at all. And the average recurrence interval for this entire sequence for 4,000 years is very, very similar, at about 180 to 190 years. What I want to point out here is that from these long sequences in California, we found that earthquake recurrence along plate boundary faults is not very regular. It's not as regular as we'd like for prediction or forecasting purposes. So, for instance, for the last 1,000 years, the average occurrence interval has been about 120 years. Whereas the previous 1,000 years, it was nearly twice that at 260 years. So we see this type of variation here and at every long site we have in California. That earthquake production on these faults has varied at about the scale of the earthquake cycle. So from this, the take-home message is you can't really characterize a hazard for a fault with just one or two earthquakes. You need to develop a longer record of earthquakes. And that could be difficult in some place like the Czech Republic because the climate conditions are so different between the Pleistocene and the Holocene that in the Pleistocene, soliflexion and gelifluxion may remove some of your record. And you may have other factors that Petra will talk about that affect the earthquake cycle. But what we find is that recurrence, even in a very fast plate boundary setting, is not as even or as periodic as we'd like. Okay, so how does this compare to this other site? This is Hog Lake. We're going to compare it to Mystic Lake up here. This is the Hog Lake record. This is the Mystic Lake record. There's some earthquakes we see at both sites. We can never say with certainty that these are the same earthquakes because they could be two earthquakes at nearly the same time. But we argue that probably they are the same earthquake. What we can say with certainty is that earthquakes at Hog Lake here are not represented. We see no evidence for them at Mystic Lake. So at least some of these earthquakes here at Hog Lake, some at Mystic Lake, did not rupture both sites. And that we can say with a high degree of certainty. So by developing multiple sites on faults, we can develop estimates of rupture length, which is also a proxy for earthquake size. And from these data, we've developed a chronologic model for all surface ruptures on San Jacinto Fault for the last 1,500 years. We're fairly complete for 1,500 years. We go back almost 2,000 years at some sites. And keep in mind, in California, our historical record is only 200 years. And we only have good historical record for 150 years. So it's really critical for us to establish these long records, whereas maybe here in the Czech Republic you have a 1,000 or 2,000 year historical record. In California, we don't have that. Okay, so one of the questions has always been, and we've always had this question in California, how do you distinguish creeping faults from seismic faults? There are some indicators that we see both in the geology and the geomorphology, and then as I already mentioned, INSAR is a great way to distinguish creep from seismic faults if they're fast enough to record an INSAR signal. But for creeping faults, we typically see no well-defined event horizons when we trench, again, 2D trenches across the fault. The colluvial wedges, if they're present at all, tend to be massive. And the reason is you're getting incremental slip, and you're incrementally eroding material from one side of the fault to the other. You don't see a nice, clean bedding in the old age. We also typically have no evidence of liquefaction at wet trenching sites for creeping faults. In contrast, the seismically active faults, they usually have well-defined event horizons, And when you open 20 trenches at a site, the event horizons are at the same stratigraphic level in all the trenches. This is a very good sign. We see these fissures filled with organic sediment that penetrate to the surface that indicate rapid opening at the surface and then fill. And then these are capped by bedding stratigraphy. We typically have evidence of liquefaction at all the wet sites that we've trenched. And colluvial wedges commonly, if not typically, show stratification with a very coarse proximal colluvial wedge capped by finer grain or distal colluvial wedge. And I'll show you a couple of examples of these. And for that, I'm going to use a surface rupture that just occurred a few years ago. This is the 2010 earthquake rupture in Baja, California, the El Mayor earthquake. Looks like we're having a shape right now. I guess it's the projector. I'm just seeing it move here. I thought maybe Chip was having a little earthquake. So, anyway, we had 120 kilometers of rupture. I'll show you a bit of this in the northern part and a couple of trenches to show you what a colluvial wedge looks like from a fault of the mill is seismically active. This is what the surface rupture looks like. This is what you can expect in the Czech Republic if you have a magnitude 7 earthquake. About 4 meters of oblique slip. Here we're measuring displacement in the field the day after the earthquake. And we've done a number of trenches, and I show you from two different environments. One, this first trench was right here. So on a very stark, steep part of a hill slope. And lo and behold, this is the rupture here from 2010. We're getting a little bit of a colluvial wedge forming right here, the gravel from the hanging wall or the upthrown wall. And then we find, buried in the stratigraphy, this is a colluvial wedge, and it's coarse gravel here, and it finds a way through the fault. This is typically what we see with colluvial wedges produced by earthquakes, especially larger earthquakes, which you get very coarse debris deposited right against the fault, and then as the scarp degrades over time, it becomes finer and finer. The second trench is where we had an uphill facing scarp. The media effect was ponding of silt against the scarp, and then development of this colluvial wedge. This is gravel. This is finer sand and grating out the silt. And here's another colluvial wedge. This is gravel grating out the sand and silt. So colluvial wedges that are seismically produced are almost always graded. Unless the amount of displacement was too small to rupture all the way through the surface soil. It's a very characteristic feature of seismically produced colluvial wedges. This was another earthquake in the same area, 1892. We can still see this in the geomorphology, offset channel wall. Here's a geologist for scale. This is the scarp coming down. There are places where the scarp is still very well expressed in the alluvium. And in the trenches, another feature we commonly see is increasing separation with depth if you have a normal component of displacement, as we do for the Laguna Salada earthquake. Here's the 2010 rupture up here. This is offset from 1892. This is offset from an older earthquake here. So you see progressively larger displacements with increasing depth with an oblique slip fault. Okay, so how do we determine the size of past earthquakes? This is always can be a tough problem if you're dealing with just a single trench site or just with 2D trenches, because sometimes you don't, if it's a strike slip fault, it does not give you much information about how much lateral displacement. So we'll go into how to determine lateral displacement on a fault. But first, just to give a little background for people not familiar with this, there are scaling relationships that relate the amount of displacement to the size of the earthquake. An earthquake, in terms of moment magnitude, is a function of the moment of the earthquake. The moment is simply the product of the average, or the area of rupture times the average displacement times the shear rigidity of the crust. So large earthquakes require big faults with lots of displacement. Smaller earthquakes require smaller rupture areas and smaller displacements. A magnitude 6 may only rupture 10 by 10 kilometers of fault with a half a meter of displacement. Magnitude 7 is going to require a fault that's at least 40 kilometers long with several meters of displacement. And a magnitude 8 is going to require a fault that's hundreds of kilometers. Subduction zones can produce magnitude 9s because they can be 1,000 kilometers or more in length, and 200 kilometers down dip and have tens of meters of displacement. So the earthquake magnitude scales directly with displacement in the area of rupture. So two critical aspects are how long were the ruptures and how much displacement occurred. And we can address both of these. As you saw with the San Jacinto, if we see earthquakes at the same age at two sites 50 kilometers apart, and we have the information on displacement, well, we can make the case that it was probably the same earthquake, but it does require multiple sites. So with that, I'm going to take you to Turkey, along the North Anatolia Fault. The North Anatolia Fault has ruptured in a sequence of earthquakes between 1939 and 1999. It essentially unzipped from east to west. So out by Erzincan, this was 1939, magnitude 7.9. It was followed in 1943, or actually 42 in the Niksar Basin with a small magnitude 7. And then 1943 is 7.7, 1944 is 7.5, and then 1957, 67, and then two earthquakes in 1999 that I'm sure you all remember, the Izmit-induced ruptures in August and September of 1999. The site we're going to look at is along the 1944 rupture trace. And one thing that's unique about the North Anatolian Fault compared to Southern California is there are no parallel faults. One thing we attribute the aperiodicity of earthquakes to in California is fault interaction. We have parallel faults, we have perpendicular faults, we have intersecting faults. So in California, if you have an earthquake on one fault, it's going to affect the state of stress on adjacent faults. In Turkey, the only effect is end-to-end interaction. This fault ruptures and loads the next section. This fault ruptures and loads the next section over here. And that's apparently what happened in this sequence of earthquakes. It was like a series of dominoes. One earthquake pushed the next section of fault to fail in a very short period of time. So the nice thing about this is that there's no other faults within 200 kilometers parallel to the North Anatolia Fault that would cause fault parallel interaction and stress, stressing by adjacent earthquakes. So we might expect this fault to behave in a more characteristic fashion, where it's more periodic with similar amounts of displacement. So let's take a look. This is the site near Girede, and recorded in the geomorphology, this is a stream that's offset from 1944, this one right here, and this channel is interpreted to be offset from 1944 and 1668. This one from just 1944. And we know from extensive work the displacement field from 1944 because along each edge of each field with crops is what's called a field boundary. And usually the Turks would take all the rocks out of the field over a period of centuries and pile them up as a line along the edge of their field. And after the earthquake, rather than adjust the fields, they just keep on plowing their fields with a jog in it, and the edges of the fields are still offset. So geologists have gone along and measured the displacements for all of these earthquakes, not only for the historical earthquakes, but there are field boundaries that predate even the 1668 earthquake. So we know displacement from 1668 and 1944 directly from offset cultural features. So deposition at this site ended sometime before 1668. We dug a series of trenches. I worked with Koji Okamura from Japan, who worked here, did a trench in 1990 and one in 2002. And then he allowed me to come in with a large excavator. And I dug in 2003 all the pink trenches here. And we came back in 2009 and dug all the blue trenches. And I was specifically looking to determine displacement. So this is fairly typical of the exposure here. Secondary faults come up. This is from event 3 and are capped by sediments in this channel deposit. This channel is offset by 1668 and 1944. So we know that this particular fault didn't move in either of those earthquakes. And it produced a fissure along the fault. We have older strands that come up and are capped by Venice stratigraphy here. We see this repeatedly in exposure after exposure. I'll just show you one more. Multiple faults come up. This is event 5. Are capped by these gravels here. What I want to point out is this gravel, this is unit 10, and this gravel, we decided to see if we could actually find the edge of it, so we dug trenches parallel to the fault, and as we were digging parallel to the fault, we came across this log, and we dug this log out, and it turns out this log had been cut down by axes, by steel axes, so it's historical. And so we took the outer three tree ring, and we got a mid-6th century date. The date's about 550 AD. And so we knew the age of this channel. Now we're going to see if we could find the margins of it. This, by the way, this is the earthquake sequence from this site. We have also found numerous pine cones. Pine cones are seeds, where they contain seeds. All the pine cones came out looking like this, and after about a week in the sun, they looked like this. So this tells us that these fell into standing water and never opened up, and so they weren't redeposited by stream flow. So they gave us very good results. We also had trees in growth position along a man-excavated drain canal, and we could date the tree rings on these trees and determine when they were planted. So this is the trench site from 2003. There's the fault right here. And it's going to go right through this excavation. I'll show you that right here. We took off the top meter of sediment because we were going to be digging trenches below 2 meters and we didn't want to have a collapse hazard. And our target was this channel margin right here. This is this dark gray channel deposit, and here was the edge of it right there. This is the same dark gray channel deposit on the other side of the fault, and you guessed it, this is the fault right there. So we went in and excavated parallel trenches to bring that channel into the fault. It's right here. You can see it right there. You can see it right there. It intersects the fault, and then it came all the way back to over on this side where we got the other edge of the channel. This was surveyed with a total station. And this is what the map looks like. So, in the end, we ended up with 23 to 26 meters of displacement. So, at this point, we knew this was from 5 earthquakes, so it averages 5 meters of displacement per earthquake. From the geomorphology and the historical offsets, we had about 4 to 5 meters of displacement in 1944 and 5 to 6 meters of displacement in 1668. So, 10 meters between the last two earthquakes. 25 meters for 5 earthquakes. It's starting to look like each earthquake produces similar amounts of displacement. So to test that, we went in and trenched a little bit to the east to see if we could find older deposits. And in this excavation, we actually found the kiln. This was a Byzantine-era kiln. They were cutting down trees and firing. They were making roof tiles and other things. And we actually found the kiln that they were using for that. And we excavated a number of trenches, both first across the fault and then parallel, because we found this channel that was in a big V shape. This is very typical of Turkish hand-excavated channels. This channel actually dated to just after the 1035 earthquake. It's a well-known earthquake. And apparently, the side with their clay, where they were mining the clay to make the tiles, was on the side of the fault that went down in the 1035 earthquake, and they dug a drain canal to drain the site so they could continue mining clay and producing tiles. So we were able to find this canal, and the shape of it in the individual trenches was going down like this. It went very deep, and so after we logged the upper 2 meters of the trench fill, we had the excavator trench all the way to the bottom of the trench, or the channel, this V-shaped channel, so that we could survey the entire perimeter. And when we were done, this is what it looked like. So each of these is the survey margins in these channels, and it comes, there's the fall right here, and it steps over very abruptly. This would be the foul end of the channel. It turns out there's some warping on one side of the fault. There's 15 meters of total lateral displacement. 12 of it is ribble displacement. And then in the channel fill itself, we had about 13 and a half meters of ribble displacement, 15 meters of total displacement. So, and this was offset in just the last three earthquakes. So now we have offset in earthquakes 1, 2, 3, and then a total for 5. So the offsets are now about 5, 10, 15 meters, and 25 meters. So this is starting to look very, very characteristic. And it also turns out that once we knew the age of this from the radiocarbon dates, all the radiocarbon dates could tell us is it occurred around the 13th or 14th century. And it turns out this earthquake was recorded in Erzincan in the Armenian records. And they describe this, this is very interesting, they describe this as a ship rolling on the sea. Now, for a seismologist, the first thought that comes to mind is long period energy. That means the earthquake was not close. They describe it as a very strong, long earthquake, but as a ship rolling on the sea, and it did no damage in Erzincan, which is 200 or 300 kilometers away. So, we think this earthquake fits very nicely with that historical earthquake. What you'll notice, though, is also the timing between earthquakes. Here, the average recurrence interval is 290 years, but only has a coefficient of variation of 48 years, which means, coefficient of variation is 0.17, which is the standard deviation of 48 years. That means it's far more periodic than any of the long earthquake records that we have in California. And we attribute that in part to the fact that it's only interacting end-to-end with adjacent segments in the fault. Okay, so this is what the earthquake record looks like for the last 1,500 years. Kind of a stair step. Here's our uncertainty in dating. Here's the displacements that we resolved from directly from trenching. And from that, we can say that the past 5 earthquakes have probably been very similar in displacement. In other words, similar in size at this site. What I didn't tell you is that 1668 was a much larger earthquake because it ruptured both the 1943 and 1944 segments as a single earthquake. But we wouldn't be able to determine that here. But that's been determined by trenching at multiple sites for over 500 kilometers of fault. Okay, so I'll conclude with this. Slip rates are the main driver of hazard. High slip rate faults are very hazardous, and low slip rate faults are much less hazardous. Kind of as a first assessment in the Czech Republic, most of your faults, or all the faults I've looked at so far, have been low slip rate faults. So, you know, without question, it's much safer to live in the Czech Republic than California. But nevertheless, I'm still right now living in California. One aspect that Petra will talk about is that check faults may be biased by past ice loading events. And so the slip rates that you do resolve on check faults may not represent a long-term hazard, so we have to look at the Holocene history to really characterize the current hazard. I think heavy-seismic studies can resolve the timing and size of past earthquakes. You can do both timing. And then with 3D studies, we can determine the size, and that gives us information on how